Mr. Denvers is entitled to a new trial for multiple reasons. This was completely unfair, and it's been unfair for 15 years. Here's why. Mr. Denvers actually testified in this trial. He testified that he did not know there was a bomb in a coffee cup brought by his friend Pilo. That's the co-defendant's nickname. And it was actually in a coffee cup. And the difficulty is Mr. Denvers cannot explain, and I cannot explain to any jury, why Pilo would place a bomb on a vehicle without a motive. Mr. Denvers had all the motive in this case. It was, according to the state, to harm the mother of his child and her new boyfriend. Now, I filed a motion in the first trial beforehand to introduce this evidence of a Home Depot bombing, where Pilo committed another bombing against a completely innocent person. He didn't know him, put a coffee cup under the wheel well, it blew up. He sat across the street and watched it. The state actually wanted to introduce it against Pilo because it was a capital trial against my client and Pilo. The court, Judge Villani, was concerned about the prejudice to Pilo, so he did not let them bring in the Home Depot bombing, which he was later convicted of. On appeal, I argued this. This court said to me, no. And one of the reasons, I'm sure, is that they had to protect Pilo having a fair trial. Now, there's a reversal from the federal court, and I'm back in front of the judge again. Filed a motion. I want to bring this up. I cannot prove the motive of the crime without showing this Home Depot bombing.
Was that motive? Did you raise that for the first time on your second go-round for the motion to introduce evidence at the Home Depot? Because before it was more like, I could see it was kind of looked at as propensity evidence, because I don't think that that original motion mentioned motive.
In the motion, did I specifically mention motive? I can't accurately answer the question. I don't want to say something that is inaccurate. However, in the second trial, that's exactly what I did. I complained about motive. I put it in the record multiple times. It's motive, and it's I'm entitled to bring it in under 48.045 subsection 2 because of motive. Look what they were able to do with.
But how are we not bound by law of the case in terms of that issue?
Because in the first trial, Justice Herndon, remember, Pilo was sitting there with us, and Judge Villani was trying to protect his rights.
Right.
In the second trial, there's no Pilo.
Yeah, but in our order, after the first trial, on page 6, I believe, we said that evidence would have been inadmissible even in a separate trial.
Okay.
So I get the argument that you were both together in the first trial, and that makes the second trial different. But to the extent we rule that this evidence would be inadmissible even in a separate trial, doesn't that foreclose the idea of this evidence being admitted?
I don't believe so, for multiple reasons. First of all, this case was overturned by a federal judge. The federal judge did not think that
on a Bruton issue.
On a Bruton issue. But, well, actually, Judge Due didn't address all the other issues that were raised because she found that the Bruton issue was yes. And additionally, if the court is not persuaded that it should have been raised for that reason, look at how they opened the door to this. In opening argument, I immediately object when the prosecutor stands up and says, here's a little nugget for you. Even Mr. Denvers, when he talked to the police, couldn't tell us what Pilo's motive was. And I objected. I'm like, that's not what he said at all. He told the police that it was over Home Depot bombing. The judge said, don't bring it up. You're not allowed to overrule the objection. Okay, so how do they get to say that my client doesn't even have a motive for Pilo when he, in fact, said he did? That opened the door once. Then what do? They put on their expert, their bomb expert, and they put in this timing device, and they asked the expert, and the expert made this statement. He said, oh, I know what that is. Mr. Hamner then says, well, it sounds to me like you've had voice inflection there. What is it? They don't realize they put in the bombing device from Home Depot. I immediately object and say, okay, now they've invited error. Now they've opened the door to this, and I want to go into it. Disturbingly, in their brief, they claim that I did not say or that I retracted that. So I brought the transcript from that day where I four times tell the judge they've opened the door. In fact, I say it couldn't be open any farther. So here, what they've done is they've been able to preclude me from putting on motive, then they tell the jury that the defense can't even say what the motive is. We're dying to say what the motive is. What's the motive? I mean, it's almost like somebody saying, I went out, I'm a friend of the Unabomber. We went to Harvard together. And he knew that I had, some problems with an ex-girlfriend and there's a bombing. But I cannot now say that that's a Unabomber who likes to see explosions or likes to watch this stuff. I have to just say that my friend, I'll call him the Unabomber, Mr. Kaczynski, was with me. And how do you explain the motive? Once the jury knows what Ted Kaczynski is about, then you know why this has happened. Pilo had exploded other bombs. He told the police he had done this. And so I could not understand how are they able to keep that out, given the fact they've opened the door twice, they've invited the error, and I have a right to show motive. I'll lose that trial 10 out of 10 times because I can see it as I argue.
Well, let me ask you this, though. I mean, if Pilo had a motive against one of these individuals or his motive was on a random bomber.
Yes.
Your client's guilt or innocence hinges on his own knowledge and or participation in it.
Yes.
Separate from anybody else's motive. So how does that motive prove a fact in controversy based on the concession it seems from the state that your guy didn't place the bomb on the car or commit the bombing in that vernacular. But if the fact in controversy is what did your client know about what was going to occur or not know about it, how does the Pilo's motive play into that?
Because once you know what Pilo's been doing, and that, I mean, in other words, the man, Ryan Wallace from the Home Depot, the victim of the Home Depot bombing, he had no motive against him. He just wanted to see it blow up. Right. So it's the same prospect. He has a motive to harm people. Pilo has a motive to harm people without any apparent motive. And that's the motive within itself, without apparent motive. In fact, it's an aggravating circumstance.
So it's like a motive is a motive of no motive.
Well, it's an aggravating circumstance on capital cases without apparent motive. I just want to go down the street and shoot people because it's really fun. I've had people who do that, right? I've had clients that do those kind of things. And so here we wanted to show that, and I couldn't show it. And as I'm arguing to the jury, I can't prove it because I can see in the jury's eyes, they're like, why would Pilo do this other than they're best friends and your client has motive? And so he was helping him out until they figure out, no, this man just likes to blow things up. He blew things up in the desert. He'd blown things up in Nicaragua. And so he just thinks this is fun. He also, as Mr. Denver's pointed out, told him, you're the only one with motive. They're going to think it's you. And that's exactly what happened. I would also like to talk about, I'd also like to address this lot number and the problem with the lot number, because they really went too far. They put up a slide in closing argument showing the battery located at the crime scene and the battery found in Mr. Denver's shed had the same lot number. They put it up in a slide and said, look, they're the lot number. And I objected again immediately, and they did this twice. And I don't know how they're getting away with that type of conduct when their own experts said it's not a lot number, it's probably expiration number. And so what concerned me with that is under Nakui versus Illinois, they can't put forth false information. And so I would like to say tell the court what the standard is, which I've listed on page 32 of the brief, and that is, was the testimony, I realize it wasn't testimony, it was in the PowerPoint. Was it actually false? Yes, it's clear. They can't even deny it's false. Did the prosecution know it was false? Yes, their own expert had said it was false. Was the false testimony material? Of course it was. It's saying, look how the bomb, there's a battery from the bomb with a lot number, and it's the same from the defendant's work shed. That was overwhelming to me, and at that point, I could do almost nothing other than just object.
You confronted during trial, you fully confronted him.
Yes,
and
I did.
Fleshed it out and,
I did. And then they put it up in trial and in the closing argument and put it up as though it happened that way. So that they knew it was false. So I think, Justice Perry-Gary, that proves the point. I confronted it. I proved it wrong. So I thought, okay, fine. They're not going to be able to argue it. Now, all of a sudden, I'm seeing it on the screen and they're putting up lot number. I'm like, why are they doing that? And I'm complaining about that. So you see, there's accumulation of error that's occurring in this case. I can't put in the motive. They're able to say things, which I still think that statement from the opening argument saying we could not prove motive. Mr. Denvers did not have a motive. I don't see how they get away with that it doesn't open the door to me being able to say it's not what he told the police. Let the defendant testify to that. I see I only have 5 minutes left, and I reserve that, please.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Oram, Eckley Keach on behalf of the state of Nevada, the respondents in this matter. Your Honors, I want to start by explaining the standard of review for all the issues that appeal in this case. The standard of review in this case is abuse of discretion. An abuse of discretion occurs if the district court's decision is arbitrary or capricious, or if it exceeds the bounds of law or reason. Now, the reason that abuse of discretion is important is because this court cannot substitute its own judgment for that of the district court absent an abuse of discretion, because the district court has a better opportunity to observe parties and evaluate the situation. That's from Wolf v. Wolf, 112 Nevada, 1355 at page 1359. Now, there are three issues consolidating everything that the appellant raises in his brief that are before this court on review. Number one, did Judge Maloney abuse his discretion in his evidentiary rulings? He did not. Number two, did Judge Maloney abuse his discretion in the suppression ruling? He did not. And number three, did Judge Maloney abuse his discretion by not declaring a mistrial? He did not. Because Judge Maloney didn't abuse his discretion, there is no cumulative error, and this court should affirm the lower court's verdict. However, if this court finds that there was error, the court should still affirm the verdict because the overwhelming evidence in this case demonstrated the defendant's guilt on all counts. I want to start by addressing what Mr. Oram talks about, which is really the evidentiary rulings in this case, that Mr. Denvers testified about not knowing about a coffee cup. He talks about his motion to introduce the Home Depot bombing, and then how there's an error with opening the door in this state's opening. He talks about the door being opened through Mr. Waltenbaugh. Respectfully, the state disagrees that the door was open in any of those issues. The standard of review for evidentiary rulings is abuse of discretion. And in this case, Judge Maloney properly applied the law and weighed the facts in concluding what he did in not finding that there was either an open door or an error as to denying the evidence of the Home Depot bombing. The controlling law in Nevada on evidentiary rulings is NRS 48025, NRS 48035, and with propensity evidence, NRS 48045. Evidence that is not relevant is not admissible. There is no constitutional right to introduce inadmissible evidence. And so if evidence can't come in under 48025, 48035, and 48045, it can't come in, period. And so I want to talk about the pretrial motion to introduce the Home Depot bombing. These are the facts that Judge Maloney relied upon in denying the Home Depot bombing. The first thing is the defendant wanted to introduce evidence of Pilo's prior bombings, but Pilo is no longer on trial. He's not a defendant in the retrial case. The focus of the retrial was solely on the present defendant, Omar Rueda Denvers. The issue of whether
doesn't that negate or go against then this more prejudicial than probative issue? If Pilo was not in fact there, it wouldn't prejudice him, but it could have gone to show motive on behalf of his co-conspirator, if you will, and maybe he didn't know about the bombing. I mean, I'm not saying that's what the jury would have found, but I'm just saying that, you know, that reasonable, that reference couldn't even be made. And so where's the prejudice versus probative value?
So that goes under 48035, the concern of their opening up effectively a trial within a trial. Under 48045, evidence is not admissible if its probative value is outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, of confusion of the issues, or of misleading the jury. The issue with letting it in, even if there is some marginal relevance to it, is that the trial isn't about the Home Depot bombing. Pilo isn't on trial. Discussing this would open up an entire new avenue of evidence, an entire new avenue of irrelevant testimony that had nothing to do with the focus of this trial, which is Omar Rueda Denvers committing the Luxor bombing. Now, as to motive, it also implicates 48045, which is prior bad acts. And under the law, prior bad acts can't be admitted either through the defendant or through any other individual. It doesn't have to be specifically a defendant-focused inquiry. If there's a prior bad act, under 48045 and it goes to propensity, it's excluded. It's not admissible evidence. And that's what Judge Bolani found in this case, is that while Mr. Oram continues to call what he's seeking to introduce motive evidence, it's merely propensity evidence. He used the analogy of the Unabomber. He said, if my friend was the Unabomber and I was hanging out with the Unabomber, everybody would know, well, the Unabomber makes bombs. Except the Unabomber is probably the worst example to give because he gave hundreds of pages of manifesto testimony showing what his motive was. He explained very clearly why he bombed everybody that he did. What Mr. Oram wants to talk about is the opposite, that Pilo has no motive. His motive is he has no motive. He likes to bomb things because he's a bomber. Therefore, when he committed the Luxor bombing, he just did it because it was in character of who he is as a bomber. That's propensity evidence. And that's what this court found in its initial law of the case in the first appellate review, that even if it's called motive evidence, it's propensity evidence because it's being admitted to show Pilo acted in conformity therewith of his character as a bomber to continue to bomb indiscriminately. Being able to admit motive evidence requires there to be a legitimate motive. Calling propensity evidence motive evidence does not satisfy NRS 48045. And so Judge Bolani weighed all these facts, and he applied those facts to the statutory laws, 48025, 48035, and 48045. And he made two separate findings. One, on the merits of the facts, he concluded admission of the Home Depot bombing and other bombings was irrelevant to the case. It would have confused the issues for the jury. And separately, that it was propensity evidence and not probative and relevant to this case. Separately, Judge Bolani also said he was also making findings in accordance with law of the case as this court had previously decided. And so I want to take a minute briefly to talk about the federal court and law of the case, because that was an issue that was brought up. Mr. Oram relies extensively in his briefing and today on the federal court's decision in this case. It's related to Demers versus Baker, 359, Federal Supplement, 3rd, 973. So I want to clarify how collateral review should impact this court. First of all, the federal judge made one ruling in this case, that the original case had a Bruton violation. That's it. She also made a lot of other comments about her opinions on the case and the facts of this case. But those comments and opinions are dicta. On the retrial, there is no Bruton violation because there's only one defendant who's being tried, Omar Rita Demers. So we get rid of the Bruton issue. But what Mr. Oram wants to do is he wants that dicta to become law of the case in this proceeding, but it can't be law of the case. Number one, the federal court isn't sitting as an appellate court in this proceeding. Taking a case to federal court for a pretrial writ of, or for a post-conviction writ of habeas corpus in federal court is a collateral civil proceeding authorized under 22 U.S.C. 2254 as a limited jurisdictional window to review constitutional issues. It is not, as this court is, an appellate court reviewing all the lower court's findings. Separately, this court is not bound by dicta, either by its own dicta or by another jurisdiction's dicta. However, this court's original decision does apply to all subsequent and prior proceedings and on appeal. And so any findings that the federal court made that were outside of its limited constitutional review of a constitutional error are federal dicta, not binding on this court, and not being made in a procedural posture as an appellate court reviewing this court. Therefore, the law of the case remains what this court held in Rated Denver's 1. If I can explain by way of analogy a little bit. Had the issue been brought before this court, and this court originally said there was a Bruton violation, and it reversed, law of the case would still apply as to all the other issues. Well, the fact that on collateral review with a narrow jurisdictional window, a federal court found a Bruton violation and reversed the court, that doesn't obviate all the other findings that the Supreme Court made. And it can't, because it's a parallel court of a different jurisdiction with a limited congressional window to review a constitutional issue. Law of the case applies in this case. It remains valid in this case. And it was one of the bases upon which Judge Bolani properly found that the Home Depot bombing and all the other evidentiary rulings that he found should remain excluded from this case. I want to move on to the lot number issue and this idea of prosecutorial misconduct. Ultimately, the question before this court is, did Judge Bolani abuse his discretion in denying a motion for mistrial? Because in the context of the second trial, that's what happened, was Mr. Orem made a motion for a mistrial on the basis of prosecutorial misconduct. He cites Nepue versus Illinois for the prospect that the state committed prosecutorial misconduct in this case. In Nevada, prosecutorial misconduct, in Nevada, Nepue is interpreted as a two-pronged test. Number one, did the prosecutor knowingly admit false testimony in the proceeding? And number two, once it was known that it was false, was there no effort to correct the issue?
So setting aside the first trial,
yes.
How did Lott, the term Lott, come up in the second trial?
Thank you, Your Honor. In order to answer this, I would like to go a little bit into the history of how it came up in the first trial.
Sure.
The concept of Lott numbers originally came up in the first trial when Pilo's defense counsel asked Waltenbaugh what the lot numbers on batteries go into the hundreds. And in that context, Waltenbaugh agreed. And that's from volume 3, page 574. In the original trial, Waltenbaugh never testified that the number 0807, this number that's at issue, was a lot number. It never was raised in direct across, redirectory across, or anything in the first proceeding where he attributes 0807 to being a lot number. Volume 3, page 574. Within the transcript, this is page 157 and paragraph 15. In closing in the first trial, the state addresses what Pilo's defense counsel raised. Pilo's defense counsel raised the lot numbers. The state followed, or brought it up in closing. Now we're in the second trial. And now to your question, Justice Herndon, about how it came up in the second trial. Prior to any evidence at the beginning of this trial, Mr. Orem said that he independently found that 0807 is not a lot number. And he said he objected to talking about it as a lot number without bringing in a representative from Ever Ready Battery because it would be hearsay otherwise. That's from volume 2, page 382. And so the state never brings in testimony from any witness that indicates 0807 is a lot number. The first time lot numbers are brought up in this case by witnesses by Mr. Orem on cross-examination of Waltenbaugh to discredit Waltenbaugh by insinuating that Waltenbaugh previously falsely testified about the existence of lot numbers. And if I can quote, this is from volume 3, page 572, within the transcript, page 151, paragraph lines 1 through 4. Mr. Orem, it's important that you testify accurately. Fair? Mr. Waltenbaugh, fair, yes. Mr. Orem, those batteries don't have a lot number on them, do they? Mr. Waltenbaugh, no, they do not. Mr. Orem, then why did you testify previously that those were lot numbers and tell Judge Maloney under oath those were lot numbers? So two things happened there. Number one, Waltenbaugh did testify honestly. He said there are no lot numbers. And then number two, Mr. Orem called Waltenbaugh a liar and saying he testified that they were lot numbers in the first trial. But for Mr. Orem introducing the discussion of lot numbers, it would have never come up. And all of a sudden, Mr. Orem has insinuated in front of the jury that Waltenbaugh is a liar. Well, now when we go to the state's closing, the state has to address it. The state has to address this line of questioning that gets brought up by Mr. Orem insinuating what was it.
Did the state do any redirect with Waltenbaugh on the issue of lot?
It did. Okay. And it was brief because we knew that the issue of lot numbers was going to be an issue in the trial. And Mr. Hamner on redirect did address whether or not he thought it was a lot number. Okay. In closing, this is what the state said. And I want to quote, this is from volume 4, page 700. The question was brought up about lot numbers with Detective Waltenbaugh and asked, didn't you talk about in another proceeding there being lot numbers 0807 on these batteries? Well, it wasn't brought up in context that somebody had asked him about that, but he was asked about lot numbers and he responded to a question about lot numbers. And so in closing in the context, it was not, hey, look at these lot numbers. It was a question was brought to Mr. Waltenbaugh about lot numbers, and Mr. Waltenbaugh responded to the lot numbers. And so it was to instruct the jury, look at the context of how these questions came up. And that's why Judge Maloney found that there was no prosecutorial misconduct meriting a mistrial. Briefly, if I can quickly go into the second part where Mr. Orem talks about the use of batteries multiple times. The evidence of the batteries, including photos of their numbers, was admitted by stipulation without objection by defense. And that's replete throughout the record. One example is volume 3. Page 499 and page 543. And there's no bar to allowing the state to argue that the same string of numbers appears in the parking lot of the Luxor and at the defendant's maintenance shed. The weight and import of those numbers is left to the jury to decide in deliberating. It's no different than saying it was the same brand of Ever-Ready 9 volts that were found at the Luxor and in the shed. And testimony was adduced throughout the trial that the same string of numbers was found on the battery at the Luxor and in the storage shed. And there was no objection from Mr. Orem about any of that testimony. In fact, Mr. Orem explicitly suggested in trial that the state should say, quote, it's an ever-ready battery. It looks the same. It has those same numbers on the bottom. And that's from volume 3, 565, trial transcript 124, paragraph 7 through 10. And then Mr. Orem agreed again when the court reiterated that the state could highlight that the numbers were the same. To quote the court, quote, he can say it's an ever-ready battery. He can say it's a 9-volt. He can say each one has 0708. And the one at the Luxor is 0708. That's fine. Mr. Orem, 0807. Yeah, that's fine. And that's the significance. So that's what the state did in closing. What the state said was there are thousands of ever-ready batteries. Arguably, there are thousands of batteries. If I can just continue this quote. Arguably, there are thousands of batteries with 0807. But the question you have to ask yourself is this. Recognizing that the same type of ever-ready battery, ever-ready industrial 9-volt with the same numeric string, 0807, is found at the scene of the bombing of the defendant's ex-girlfriend and her lover, and at the defendant's place of work, you have to ask yourself, what are the odds? What are the odds that the same make of battery, the same model of battery, and the same numerical string, whether it be a date, an expiration date, whether it's just a thousand different batteries that have a numerical string, all those things, what is the likelihood that all of that will show up at the defendant's workshop? So that's what the state said when it introduced it, and that's what the state said in its closing of the PowerPoints. The same thing Mr. Orem suggested the state do, the same thing Judge Villani said the state could do, that's what it said in closing. There was no discussion of lot numbers, and there was no prosecutorial misconduct. Because Judge Villani did not abuse his discretion in any of the findings, either in the evidentiary rulings or the suppression motion or the motion for mistrial, I would ask that this court affirm the jury's verdict and find that the defendant's verdict was valid. If there are no other questions from the panel, I'll rest.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We will add a minute to Mr. Orem's time as well. Thank you, Mr. Keach.
I'm moving backwards. That lot number is now a little more distressing to me. Before we started that closing argument, it was real clear. They had backed off the lot number. I think he's right. In the first trial, it hurt us. It was a capital trial. In that second trial, I went to go look at that lot number, see is it a lot number. And what I found is no, it's actually an expiration date. So yes, I attacked their expert because I'm like, we're going to stop this right now. And it was stopped. So at the time of closing argument, we were all in agreement. It's not a lot number. When the prosecutor gets up in closing argument, and now I'm seeing slides with 0807, lot number, and that's what...
So was lot, the word lot on a PowerPoint slide?
Yes, okay. Twice, in two slides. In two slides, they did it. And so when I hear the prosecution now saying, oh, no, this was an agreement from Mr. Orem, he attacked the expert, oh, well, sure, I cross-examined him. It was, you know, in the first trial, I could put my client to death. Okay, and I wasn't successful, but my research after showed it's not a lot number. And they knew they'd lost that. So everything I just heard, I didn't really understand it. I think the state has to concede. They conceded before it's not a lot number. So why are they putting it up in a PowerPoint slide?
Did you get a chance to look at those exhibits before they went up?
I did not. I did not, or I would have told them. And I suppose, Justice Perry-Gary, you could say, well, why didn't you? Maybe that was something I should have done. I didn't do it. It was closing an argument. When I saw it, I objected immediately and told the judge. And that nothing was ever clarified on that. Additionally, let's talk about motive. I don't understand why I'm not allowed to bring that up in motive. You know what their motive was? They brought out that my client hated Mexicans. What does that have to do with anything? They just brought that up because they got one witness who hated my client's guts saying that, and then they just couldn't stop telling the jury. I always figure that makes it very difficult because we do have different – there are people on the jury that may be highly offended by something along those lines. But I can't bring out that this man is committing bombings for no reason. That Home Depot bombing was just for the fun of it. He sat across the street. He blew this guy's vehicle up, an employee from Home Depot, and he sat across the street in our case, too. Sat across the street and watched and then told my client, you have no chance. They know it's going to be you. So now my client's between a rock and a hard place. We have a right to introduce motive, and I would like to – I'm not sure if it was
counsel,
a case –
Counsel, what about the notion that you want to bring it in for motive, but the motive is that he has propensity for bombing? So how do we reconcile those two concepts? Because I'm struggling between the line here, between propensity and motive, and I think counsel's argument elucidated that point.
Yes. The evidence of Pilo's prior bombings gives him a motive. The satisfaction of constructing and detonating bombs, the fact that these bombs committed do not have a shared motive, or a victim independent of the bombing is a motive in and of itself. That's all I wanted to show. I don't want to show he's a bad guy, so therefore he did it. I want to show this is the motive. It's no different than them saying, oh, he hates Mexicans. And so since he hates Mexicans in one instance, apparently, or something along those lines, he must hate Mexicans here. But I can't bring out the most important facts of the case. It will change the outcome. I think they're terrified of it because they know they won't win this trial. And I'd like to also bring out to show how really irresponsible I thought the prosecutor's opening argument was. If I could. Mr. Denver's even, this is opening argument. And this is an interesting nugget. You'll get to hear the evidence. Omar actually tells the police, listen, Pilo had no motive to hurt Willibaldo. That's not true. He did tell the police, and he told the police, I think it's over the Home Depot. Maybe he did this. Maybe this is why he's done it.
Well, but you don't seem to be arguing that Pilo had a motive to hurt anybody, just that Pilo had a motive to blow stuff up.
Yes.
Just randomly, not that he had the motive with these people, just randomly like to put bombs out.
Yes, but then for the state to say that Pilo can't, that my client can't give a motive, that's completely an opposite to the facts. They got away with it. They're able to say that Pilo had no motive to hurt, and they're actually saying that my guy can't articulate a motive, but he can articulate a motive, and I'm telling the judge immediately. I moved for a mistrial in the opening argument, which is very rare. I said, listen, how are you letting them get away with that? I can show you in the defendant's statement. And I actually remember showing the prosecutor during the break. I'm like, look what he said. Look what you've said something that's in opposite to the truth. And that's why Nate Pooley is very difficult in this particular case, because of that lot number, because of the fact that they are not letting me tell the truth to the jury. And that is, he did say that Pilo had a motive, and I can't explain it. There is no way to explain this without going into that information. Additionally, in Ledbetter, and I'm not sure, I argued Ledbetter, and I remember it was a very difficult case, and this court ruled against me in 2006 and said, it therefore remains the law in Nevada that whatever might motivate one to commit a criminal act is legally admissible to prove motive under NRS 48.045. I had a right to bring that out. We did under the statute. I see my time is done. If there's no further questions, I have submitted to the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Arm, thank you. Gentlemen, thank you both. We're going to go ahead and have the matters stand for submission. I appreciate your arguments very much today, and the court will be in recess until the next call of court.